Charitable giving is not yet back to pre-recession levels, so there are signs that things are starting to look up, if only a little. Charities would like 2012 to be the year of the turnaround. NPR's Pam Fessler reports on the challenges that stand in the way.
Ever since the recession, the talk among charities has pretty much been doom and gloom. But recently, there's been a teeny bit less doom.
We're doing well.
Nancy Leopold is executive director of College Tracks, a small charity in Montgomery County, Maryland.
By that, I mean we're doing as well as we were at this time last year, or a little better, and that's despite having to make up for some foundation money.
Which isn't as plentiful as it used to be in the bad economy. So Leopold's group, which helps hundreds of low-income teens get into and stay in college, has turned its attention to wealthy individuals who still have money to give. With striking results, their individual gifts have doubled over the past year.
I think the people who do give in an economy like this recognize that their dollars are needed even more.
Across the country, nonprofits are looking for new ways to get through tough times, whether it's refocusing their fundraising or changing the way they get their message across. One of the most promising results has been a greater use of the internet and a surge in online giving.
Just as we're doing more shopping online, and we did this past holiday, we're doing more of our giving online.
Katya Andreessen is with Network for Good, a site that allows donors to give to any charity. The group saw a 20% increase in online donations last year, and Andreessen is optimistic about 2012. She says technology has opened up new ways for people to act on their natural inclination to give, such as the ability to text donations to charities via cell phones.
If you have a device in your hand next time you walk past a homeless person, or you hear a news story and it makes you want to do something and you're on a website and there's an immediate way to act, I think that really opens the door to unlock that generosity and increase that charitable giving pie.
We think 2012 could be a slightly stronger year for giving at Catholic Charities.
Roger Connor, spokesman for Catholic Charities USA, says his group is encouraged in part by online giving, including an individual $9,500 gift they received in the final weeks of 2011. He says a major poverty summit later this year should also focus more attention on the charity's efforts to help the poor. Still, he says, any growth will likely be modest.
I don't think we're predicting more than, you know, anything from 1 to 3%.
And that's pretty much what many charities say. In a survey last month, the Chronicle of Philanthropy found that a slight majority of nonprofits were seeing an increase in end-of-year giving, some as high as 20%. But editor Stacey Palmer says most groups are not raising nearly as much as they did before the recession.
So it's going to be a tough year, and some people think it's going to be a tough year for fundraising until 2016.
She says even as the economy rebounds, it could take a couple more years for charities to catch up. That increased donations often are not enough to cover other losses.
Most groups get a lot of their money from state and federal governments, and that's where they're seeing very big cuts,
which are expected to continue and even grow in 2012. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
Our last word in business today is yogurt, actually yogurt and beer. Maybe not a combination you want to consider first thing in the morning, or maybe ever, but those two products will be together in this year's Super Bowl.
That's because Danone yogurt is making its advertising debut at the big game this year. Apparently, it's the first time a commercial for yogurt will be featured during the big game. It may also be the healthiest food ever marketed at the Super Bowl. You can dip your Doritos in the yogurt. Danone will air its spots alongside the ever-present ads for Bud Light, as well as Doritos and Pepsi Cola, a couple of other Super Bowl regulars.
Companies are paying a record $3.5 million for 30-second spots this year. That's $500,000 more than last year, and NBC, which airs the big game, is all sold out of ad time. And that's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. In the year that just ended, hospitals stepped up their spending on advertising. Blake Farmer of member station WPLN reports that academic medical centers are some of the latest airing commercials coast to coast.
The biggest spenders on advertising are also, not surprisingly, the household names. Mayo Clinic, Mount Sinai, and New York Presbyterian led the way for the first half of 2011. Overall, hospitals shelled out 20% more during that period than in the prior year, according to the research firm Kantar Media. One of the newcomers trying its luck on the national stage is Vanderbilt University Medical Center.
And the most amazing part is that the most amazing part is yet to come. That's the promise of discovery.
In the last year, the Nashville-based teaching hospital bought ad time on CNN, Fox News, and NPR. Jill Austin is Vanderbilt's chief marketing officer.
We think of it almost as a service to the public to get the word out.
The Vanderbilt ads primarily focus on treatments for cancer and heart disease that are based on an individual's DNA. But Austin says luring patients hasn't been the primary goal.
Ultimately, it helps us attract students to Vanderbilt, faculty and staff. You know, we ourselves are proud of the work that we do. So it's really focused in that direction.
Despite what some institutions say, Joel English of the Milwaukee-based marketing firm BVK says the thrust of national marketing isn't recruiting or even fundraising.
There are ancillary benefits to a effective regional or national campaign. That said, during a time in healthcare where dollars are precious, I don't believe those would be the key reasons for a national campaign. I think the key reason is to attract more patients.
Several teaching hospitals have tried raising their national profiles in recent years. The University of Pittsburgh Medical Center launched a multi-million dollar campaign in 2005. The University of Michigan Health System has been on NPR and bought ads in the New York Times Sunday magazine. English says a lot of the impetus is shrinking Medicare and Medicaid reimbursements, which put a particular squeeze on teaching hospitals.
To sustain their research and education and patient care, they have to extend beyond their traditional geographic boundaries.
The concept is relatively new. 20 years ago, you wouldn't catch an academic medical center using its name and the term marketing in the same sentence, says Betsy Gelb, a University of Houston marketing professor.
We have gotten to the point where it's not a dirty word.
Gelb points to nearby MD Anderson Cancer Center, part of the University of Texas. It launched its first national campaign in 2009.
There's only one you, and only one MD Anderson.
The TV spots and print ads are meant for the eyes of patients who've gotten a tough diagnosis. But Gelb says as much as anything, the institution wants its name in front of physicians who ultimately make the referrals. The goals vary, Gelb says, and most are hard to measure.
You can't necessarily quantify it. Hey, 56 patients came in last year. But you can say the difference from before to after is significantly positive, or it isn't.
For the latest to broaden its horizons, Vanderbilt reports a statistically significant change. However, the University of Michigan Health System wasn't exactly thrilled with the results of its national ads. A spokesman says it recently moved its national marketing away from pricey traditional media and to the web instead. For NPR News, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
Last night, Michigan defeated Virginia Tech 23-20 in the Sugar Bowl, one of the five bowl games that make up college football's bowl series. It was a thrilling overtime finish for the Wolverines, but commentator Frank DeFord was likely not watching.
The bowl championship series climaxes Monday with a game in New Orleans between Louisiana State and Alabama for the national bragging rights to Dixie. As there is a joke about the Holy Roman Empire, that it was neither holy nor Roman nor an empire, so can the same be said about the bowl championship series. It's not a bowl. It's a game played in the Superdome. It's not a championship, just an exhibition, because the teams have been appointed to show up without earning the right to challenge for the title. And it's not a series because no team plays more than once. No wonder the BCS is so despised. Remember Diogenes, the guy who browsed around with a lantern looking for just one honest man? Well, I am the Diogenes of the BCS. For armed with a bullhorn and a searchlight, I've traveled this great land of ours, desperately hoping to find just a single fan of the BCS. But alas, I've found nary a one. Still, we Americans continue lobotomized to accept the BCS as legitimate when it's the goofiest competition this side of the Iowa caucuses or the People's Choice Awards. But if we should just think about it for a moment and apply its arranged manipulations to other sports, we could realize how unfair and imbecilic the bowl championship series really is. Consider, if the BCS ran the Olympics, the 100-meter final would be held in September, 6 or 7 weeks after the scheduled heats. That, you see, is consistent with the cuckoo BCS scheduling. LSU's last game was on December 3rd, Alabama's way back in November, 45 days ago. Nowhere else in sport is there such a pointless, bizarre interval. If the BCS ran the NFL, there would be no playoffs. Instead, a bunch of mysterious computers and some dubious experts, many of whom have conflicts of interest, would just declare which teams qualified for the Super Bowl, then schedule the matchup 45 days from now, of course. If the BCS ran the World Series, tens of millions of dollars would still be made, and the leagues and the owners and the managers and everyone connected with the series would be paid. Well, everyone except for the players. But you see, this is in keeping with the BCS rationale that players are actually much happier playing when they aren't burdened by making money. If the BCS ran the World Cup, there would be no World Cup. Instead, there would just be a mind-numbing plethora of meaningless little soccer matches, international bowl games played between disparate countries like Peru versus Slovenia, scheduled at random neutral sites like Sri Lanka. I hope you enjoy watching the arranged marriage that the BCS is putting on Monday.
Commentator Frank DeFord joins us each Wednesday from WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer.